think I'm here.
I think you're here too. I can hear you. So that's a positive.
That's a start. That's a start. With this microphone, that's good.
Ian, how you doing? Can you hear us?
Hey, doing good. How am I?
Awesome.
Excellent.
All right. Cool. So we got us a show or something resembling one.
Hey, so maybe, Mike.
Hey, it may be a very short show, but we have a show.
Yeah, you know, we're easing back into it, just coming out of the AC/DC, so it's okay. I had originally set up tonight for to be a talk about the AC/DC and everything we did, but we've talked about it so much over the last, you know, week and a half or so between the talk shows and some of the messages going back and forth with some of the participants that I just wanted to talk about literally anything else. And so,
he should be lots to talk about, right, Mike?
Not really. Exactly. I mean, I was trying to remember. I made a list of these things like a year ago, topics we could pull from, and this is the only one that popped into my head. And I honestly don't have a whole lot on it.
Well,
we should have one or two other ideas in our back pocket. Mods.
So you're the one that brought up the idea of talking about modifications and tweaks and whatever for games. In addition to that, Ian had been posting some stuff online about some different tweaks and changes and messing around with some game stuff where you've been playing with some things for ground combat in sci-fi, particularly the Traveler universe. And it doesn't take much prodding to get Mike to talk about Traveler. So I kind of put two and two together and figured I could just like throw this at y'all and get out of the way. So,
I don't know.
So welcome to the audience that we are now starting season 6 of Mention and Dispatches. I mean, not bad for a bunch of guys who really didn't know what they were doing when this all started out. We're up to season 6 of Mention and Dispatches. So, you know, 3.5-ish years of doing this now, 2.5 years of doing this now. And Mike, you know, obviously our podcasting history goes back, you know, 6 years now, 7 years, something like that.
Something like that.
Yeah. You know, once you roll in all the podcasts we've been doing, fortunately, we've been able to wrangle Ian into joining us for a bunch of these. So that's been good as well. And so we have a little bit of business we got to get out of the way before we dive into tonight's topic. First of all, we did just finish up with the AC/DC here at the Armchair Dragoons. That was the Armchair Dragoons digital convention that we held over MLK weekend. It's not really that we held it here, right? I mean, it was a digital convention. We held it everywhere. And so the wrap on that, and we'll talk more about this with an AC/DC specific episode later in the season, but we had over 100 tickets or over 100 badges for the AC/DC out there, including the GMs. But still, that was pretty cool. And
impressive.
We stretched it from 1.5 days out to 2.5 days worth of gaming. We went Friday afternoon plus Saturday and Sunday. It was a good time. Folks seemed to enjoy it. So one of the other things that we launched right around that same time is we also launched a Patreon. So you can go find us at patreon.com/armchairdragoons. And so that is out there for folks that would like to help support us, help keep Armchair Dragoons live and on the web and on the air. Part of what happens with the Patreon, we have a couple of different levels, but one of those levels includes that you get a by name shout out here on the podcast and that we thank you for being one of our Patreon supporters. So we're going to do that at the end of the show. So don't let me forget to thank our Patreon supporters when we get to the end of the show here. But with that business stuff now out of the way, game mods. And Mike, what was it that you had originally sort of put out there in the forums and kind of had in mind when you were talking about game mods and what people may have done to some of their games along?
So this, I've kind of thought about this for a while since I've been board gaming, and this goes back to, I guess, PC gaming really too. But I know that with PC games, PC war games, you see a lot of modifications that people do. You know, some people don't like some of the graphics they're using the PC games, and they'll put in NATO counters in place of 3D counters and things like that. But it got me to thinking, just how much does this go on in the actual tabletop physical board game world. And I know, speaking for myself, I do quite a bit of game modification. but I really don't see much of it on our forums. I don't see, you know, many people talking about things that they do. You will see some of it on Board Game Geek, but not to any great detail, I don't think. So when I guess you were asking for possible potential topics for the podcast, to me, this seemed like something that I don't think I've ever encountered in any great detail anywhere else. And I was just curious as to what others' thoughts were on it, or maybe what other people have done to modify their games. And we can talk about, you know, in more detail exactly what I mean by modification. I can tell you one thing. One of the first solo games that I got, Don't Tread on Me, first thing I did was I created my own board for it because I did not like the artwork of the original board. So kind of things like that. That's kind of where I was going with the whole game modification topic.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. That makes sense. So a question then as to whether or not, again, not to get overly buried in definitions, and Lord Ian's probably rolling his eyes right now. Damn it. Another podcast about definitions. But just for some clarification, when you're talking about sort of mods and modifying some stuff to games, like you mentioned, just changing out the board for Don't Tread on Me, you didn't change any of the mechanics or the gameplay or like start house ruling anything. You just, you know, hey, I don't like the look of that. Let me swap it out for something I like the look of better. Correct.
So that's part of it. I mean, yeah. So there's different, I guess, levels of modification you could do. And I think one of those would be house ruling. And we can talk about that a little bit later too. But yeah, certainly for me, it's the aesthetics of it, the whole, I don't like this board, I'm going to make a new one. And actually when I made the board for Don't Tread on Me, there was I think it was the Congress, the Congress counter I didn't like. So I just printed up my own counter. And just with my own graphics on it. So yeah, it could be the board, the graphics, maybe the cards or, you know, any of the physical components that you don't like. Another one I did was Victory in the Pacific, which I think actually bought that one from Banzai Cap. But you know the board for Victory in Pacific. It's hideous.
There are a few uglier than it, but not many.
I grabbed a file off of Board Game Geek that someone had also, I guess, decided that was not an easy to look at game board. And I sent it off to, I think it was Print and Play. And, you know, for $20-$25, got a brand new board and it looks much better.
So Ian, just swapping out alternate artwork, is that sufficient to be saying we're modding a game, or is that just sort of, you know, kind of cosmetic upgrades, but we're not really fundamentally doing anything to the game itself?
Certainly changing the components, swapping out different counters, putting on a different map. That's one form of modding a game, and that's maybe, you know, the physical look and feel of the game. I've done several times. I love the Victory in the Pacific map. I hate the Victory in the Pacific map. What I do with mine is I just add boxes, some play cards around the side to put for like ports and things like that. So I modded the game, make it a little bit more, I guess, user friendly. My counters are old and dying. I have a set of new counters that I tried to make myself because the other ones are just getting so worn out. But doing components is one part, but the second part that Mike talks about there is the rules. House rules are the most famous part, but I'd say part of the other stuff is everybody wants to tinker with making their own scenarios. I call that modding a game. Some games actually encourage it. Some games, you know, some designers don't like that, but they give you the game. Why don't you make it your own game? So for me, I look at it. The components is still one part, the rules and scenarios, and trying to, how do I mod all those different pieces? Some are better than others. Some are, some work better and some don't.
Yeah, I would agree that scenarios are definitely a big part of that too. And, you know, you will see people will create some scenarios for their games, and they'll post those on sites for people to download. So that is another type of modification, definitely.
Some games encourage it, you know, especially a lot of your tactical games. I wouldn't say squad leader, but even like your Panzer, MBT, some people have come up with like point buy type systems so you can try to build a scenario to balance it. As I was digging through tonight, thinking about what scenarios were for balancing, I actually went and looked at Lieber McCon Wood's wing leader on his site, airbattle.co.uk, he actually puts out a little guide for scenario creation. And it's a 20-page guide for, hey, this is some advice for how to write a scenario. This is things that work, maybe things you want to consider. So, I mean, he's encouraging it. Go off and make the game your own. Build something. But along the way, he's also saying, hey, but here's what I had in mind when I was doing it. So if you break it, you know, okay, you broke it. Maybe you'll understand why you broke it, but go ahead and try. Go push it along. See what happens.
Yeah, there's I think so. The variant artwork, I think, is something that a lot of folks sort of take a hand in initially, and you know, sort of the first taste is free, kid. You know, that I think lots of folks out there have sort of fiddled around with some variant artwork as kind of a baby step towards eventually doing other things to some of the games. Mark Mahaffey, who is a well-known war game artist, has done some absolutely gorgeous maps. I mean, some of these things are frame worthy that you would have no problem hanging in a library somewhere. They're just absolute works of art. He's gone back through a handful of different classic games and created some much, much better looking maps. Just, I guess, because he was bored. I don't think he was asked to do them by anybody, but there, you can see him on his website, and there's some pretty nifty ones. He did one for Columbia Games Crusader Rex, the game of the Crusades, as you would probably guess from that name. the original Crusader Rex map was not ugly. It was utilitarian, but it wasn't ugly. And it just wasn't anything to write home about. But Mark's reimagining of it is absolutely gorgeous. The guys in the Wargame Artwork group on Facebook that Gary Crockover runs, Gary has done some really excellent redos of maps over the years. He did one for Third Reich it's a fantastic map. Gary's done a variety of maps over the years. Mike, to something you would be interested in, he has redone the maps and counters for both Carrier and Flat Top over the years.
Yeah. So, and I, you know, I've owned two copies of Flat Top, and that's actually one of the ones I started to make counters for until I realized how many counters there were.
Yeah. Well, there's that. Go look up Gary's. Gary's are pretty good. But so Gary runs this Wargamer artwork group on Facebook, and a lot of the folks on that group sort of get started playing around with artwork by redoing someone else's map or making their own versions of counters out there. The classic France 1940 war game from Avalon Hill, somebody had remade the counter sheets that were floating around on the web that have a nice gradient background to them. The step reduction for the reverse side is much more obvious than the old Avalon Hill counters. These things are really nice looking. There are some people that have done some really good variant artwork out there that you can go look up and take a look at.
Yeah, so I bought,
if that's the area that you're in.
I bought 1776 off of eBay, and looking for a copy to buy, I noticed that, yeah, there were people that actually made, and I bought a copy I bought some counters with the game because they look so darn nice, but it was somebody had made up variant counters for all of the counters. Plus I think they added leaders to it or something like that, but beautiful counters. I mean, they're just well beyond anything that came with the original game.
Yeah. Yeah. And with making up some of your own counters on stuff, you know, you'd mentioned your Victory in the Pacific ones, probably the ink's worn off them at this point, but yep. Were you just making copies of older ones, or did you sort of go through a bit of a graphics upgrade or go find somebody that had done a graphics upgrade and try and tweak from there?
Well, at first I started just say, I can just make up some of my own here and just sort of duplicate what was there. At one time, there was a website out there that actually had like all the counter scans. I can't think of the site now. It used to be back on
iSimulacrum. Yeah, it was the iSimulacrum guys.
Yes, maybe. But so, I mean, that was okay, grab that. But quality of the scans was meh. So then you just start sort of making up your own. And I remember back, you know, here I am. Old dog, old grognard. Back in the days when you could buy like a sheet of counters, and then you practically like hand draw, you know, your new ones on it. Then you went to stickers, but just looking at what we have today with what you have the ability to print at home, the quality of the printers and everything, it's gone so far. And now, I mean, face it. I mean, for love it or hate it, things like Gloomhaven and stuff with minis. And now we've got print on demand, 3D printers at home and all your STL files and that sort of stuff. I mean, we're always going to be blinging out our games when we can, just because, you know, it is a very graphical medium. It's a very graphical medium, and just making it so that it looks better, feels better, is more enjoyable to play with. It's inevitable. But it's also going to be a lot more, and it's going to keep going. You're never going to be able to catch it.
Yeah. You mentioned blank counters. You can still buy blank counter sheets. GMT sells some, and I believe it's Just Plain War Games, or it's Pacific Rim Publishing. They've got the Just Plain War Games website. That there are
a couple of different places. Go look at a place like Game Crafters, and the ability to buy components. Or, you know, I was really happy with GMT, the guys who did the cards for the Downtown series. Downtown, Elusive Victory, and Red Storm. The cards that were sitting on charts, they converted into playing cards. You could just deal them out and have them in front of you. That little simple sort of at your home mod that the GMT said, yeah, go ahead, put it up there and sell it. That's fine. That's the beauty, you know, the modern medium that we can build on. So yeah, you can make the game, and maybe the I don't bemoan the folks who did Victory in the Pacific for that map. They did what they could with what they had. They were stuck with an eight color print process, so they did what they could. Nowadays, if the guys, the Leader Games, was doing it with Root and Kyle Farron, it'd be a lot different looking, for sure.
Well, that's not to say that there aren't modern ugly maps either, though.
I'm responsible for at least one of them. The original map for the old Warfighter series games, the movement to contact map wasn't too bad, but it was Fort Irwin, right? There's only so much you can do to mess up a desert map. I'm not saying it hasn't been done, but that was even beyond my capabilities to mess up a desert map. But the second game in the series, when I did the guards, which was British operations in sub-Saharan Africa, again, hypothetical kind of stuff. It was more representation, historical based. The original maps for that, atrocious. God, they were garish. It was, I was a kid in a candy store, having learned how to do a bunch of stuff in Photoshop, and I wanted to do it all. And they were bad. And I went back and redid my own maps over, you know, about a year later. I was like, I just can't live with this anymore. And I started redoing my own maps. And part of it was getting the bigger maps ready for the World of Conflict box set that never quite saw the light of day, but also part of the maps for Asian Thunder when I was working on that. The Maneuver Warrior, Asian Thunder, World of Conflict sets for the Warfighter series, I went and redid all the maps. And I was much, much happier with how the later maps turned out, where I toned down a lot of the garishness of it all. And so, you know, in some cases, it may be people sort of playing around with redoing the graphics just to learn how to do graphics better. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. If you create something, you go, hey, guys, here's an alternate. What do you think? Is this kind of cool? If you'd like to use it, here it is. I think as long as you're not charging for it, you're not going to run into any copyright issues. Although we'll immediately get a bunch of tweets from lawyers telling us how wrong I am right now. Like, I totally get that. I am not a lawyer. Don't take legal advice from me. But I think there's, you know, if you're just like, hey, here's an alternate version of this pretty picture, what do you think? And let people choose to use it or not. That's kind of up to them. But I know for me, I learned a lot over the years of how I would like the maps. And, you know, that may have applied also to the guys doing some of that early graphic design, whether it was TSR, SPI, or wherever. They, you know, Simonson and McGowan and all those guys got better over the years. You know,
so, absolutely.
But it's also, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
No, and it's also symbolic, I think, of the change of the hobby, is that nowadays you get folks, look at the artists that Hollenspiel hires. I mean, really nice graphics artists that really bring a good understanding of the color palettes and such to the maps. And that's something that we just didn't have in the hobby back in the good old days that we have nowadays.
Emphasis on old at this point.
Awesome, take advantage of it. Yes, very old.
Well, yeah. And now, you know, we're making this and we're making this transition now to even more digital with things like Tabletop Simulator. And look at what's been done with Tabletop Simulator in artwork. You know, it's look at what Cyrano does with Saturday Night Fights. His Command and Colors games look very little like what you would buy in the box and put out on a table to play.
Well, yeah, because he swapped out the blocks for minis.
Right. I mean, but is that a game modification? But it's beautiful, though. I mean, it's just it adds so much more to the game when you play it. You know, it's that immersion in the atmosphere, I think, that we're all looking for. Well, most of us, anyway.
I think there's absolutely a case to be made that, you know, the graphics swaps like we're talking about is definitely modding a game. That's in fact how many of the computer games end up, you know, being modded, as they start off with, you know, let's just change the graphics. And the Tiller games are a great example of that. The Squad Battles games have, I don't know, 10, 12 different packages of visual modifications that you can get for them that change the look of the game. And that's where a lot of people start. I know Jim Snyder, Captain Darwin, in our forums, who is one of the developers on the Flashpoint campaign series for On Target Sims. And we're talking digital gaming, not tabletop gaming, but he got his start with a lot of the code piece. Now, the dude is brilliant. He is literally a rocket scientist. Like, that is his day job. He is a rocket scientist. But he got it. One of his big early projects was doing a bunch of mods for a World War One dogfighting game, and it was the full canvas jacket mod set for a World War One dogfighting game. And that's one of the places he got his start, was sort of poking around with those. So I think graphics mods, swapping out the way things look, is definitely one level at which we start talking about modding the games. And, you know, I think we've all done that, it sounds like, to varying degrees.
And then the other thing I would add is, beyond that, is blinging up your game. So if you watch, if you've watched any of my videos on My Own Worst Enemy, and the two of you out there know who you are, you see that I bring things into the game. Like, when I'm playing an actual tabletop game, I'll bring in clear plastic discs to show units that have moved, or even cubes to show units that have moved, or other things. So there's also the other part of this, other than just changing things out, I think maybe adding more to the game than what you were given. I think that's another modification that, you know, that maybe people do.
Well, the Litco guys have built an entire business on, you know, those sorts of accessories.
Exactly. And I own some of their stuff. But exactly, that's what I mean. They sell the little explosion markers and all that's the counters. They have like the Gloomhaven counters. I don't know what you would use them for in a war game necessarily, but I'm sure I could think of something.
Ian, you were jumping in there, man.
Yeah, I was going to say that, you know, it's actually given rise to a whole other business, and that's the whole game accessories. I mean, how many of us, you know, quick answer, Brant, do you have a dice tower? Do you have a dice tray?
I have a couple.
Yes, and, you know, dice. Just, you know, let's not even talk about, like, you know, buying your own custom dice for a game, or just to have for yourself. The accessories.
If you start turning this into a test, I have a feeling I'm going to have a fairly high score on this. One of the first origins I went to, Chessex was still there, where they used to bring the little custom dice engraver with that you could pick out dice. They were blank on, I want to say it was on the 6. They were blank, and so you could pay them. You had to buy the die itself, and then you know for a dollar each, they would put whatever custom graphic on there. It had to be a vector file, but they would put whatever custom graphic on there you wanted. So I've got 6 dice here somewhere engraved with the little bayonet from the middle of the Bayonet Games logo.
So that's not true to me. That's not true game mod, but that's still modifying your experience.
But when you start adding on dice towers and custom dice and all that, yeah, I'm that guilty. I'll just assume I've got them all.
or even like organizers, like the Plano boxes, or, you know, get really fancy and go to Broken Token and get custom-made game organizers.
Yeah. Remember what I just said about just assume I have them all? I have the Broken Token organizer for 7 Wonders.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So, but
yep. Guilty as charged.
Yeah. and
we probably all 3 own the Dice of Shame Dice Tower 2 from Broken Token. I know I do.
Actually, I do not, because I have so many other Dice Towers. I was good. I didn't have to buy more ones from Broken
Token. There's always room for one more.
Yeah. I remember one time when I was talking about some cool-looking dice I had seen in the exhibit hall, but I just wasn't sure I was going to buy some more dice, or that I needed some more dice. And our buddy Cyrano looked at me and said, "Well, do you have them all?" "Of course not. More dice." It's infallible logic, right? How do you argue with that? So,
Steve Jackson recently did a Kickstarter for a dice set, and it was a weather dice set, I think it was. And of course, I get these notices that these things are going on because I bought stuff from them before. But I clicked on the link and I go to the Kickstarter page. I'm like, well, why would you need weather dice? And I was kind of looking at it. And I was like, that's pretty cool. If you're playing an RPG and you need to know weather randomly, then of course I had to order a set.
So, yes, if you're doing a hex crawl or you're solo gaming in an RPG, the weather die is handy.
Why not?
Ian, I think we derailed your conversation about sort of accessories to modify your experience there, I think.
No, that's exactly the point. But, you take the game and you modify it for yourself. You modify it, even if it's just bringing your lucky dice in or people, I hate. There are certain games, the one game came with some dice and I don't think it ever, a set of D6, I don't think it ever rolled higher than a 3, so I immediately swapped those out because there's no way I can enjoy the game if I'm never going to roll anything larger than a 3. I mean, they were just horrible dice.
It sounds using a Saturday Night Fight.
You need to talk to Lou Zaki about that. That's the problem you're
having. Yes, the classic, the classic Zaki talks. I have some of his dice.
Everyone knows at least
submit the warranty card for his dice.
I did.
All right.
Back in the day.
Yeah. I will say I own a fair number of off the wall dice just for the sake of having them be sort of off the wall. And, look, this is the podcast. We sort of digress. That's kind of our shtick. Circling back around to some of the game mods, we had mentioned making some changes to or building your own scenarios out of the existing games. And let's face it, like the ASL community is notorious for this. They build, there are entire ASL clubs that build their tournaments around their own scenarios and then sell those scenario packs after the fact. Like that's what the dudes down in Tampa do with the ASL society down there. There's the dudes, I want to say they're up in Canada somewhere. Again, every time I go into Gamer's Armory, I'm astounded by some other really cool something that is on the shelf for ASL that I have no idea where Scott got it, but it's something for ASL that somebody published along the way. Tons of folks making their own, is the Lone Canuck Publishing guys. That's who I was trying to think of. Tons of folks making their own ASL scenario packs. That, again, not publishing maps, not publishing counters, just, hey, here's a scenario, and here's the historical situation, here's the order of battle, here are the pieces you need, special rule or two, go play a scenario. Everywhere.
And certain games encourage that more than others, and I think you'll see a lot of the tactical games encourage that as, hey, here's a geomorphic map, sort of a generic sort of map, mm-hmm. and you just sort of pull your pieces together. You can have here's a meeting engagement, and you can do a meeting engagement with the Germans and the Americans or the Germans and the Russians. And, it's the same map. Sometimes even it might even be, somewhat similar counters. But just go ahead and make your own and go off and create your own scenario. It's like, hey, they gave me an M4 76, but I really want the EZ8. Well, I'm just going to, adjust a couple of counters or throw a different counter in the mix and change something. And that's when you get into the next part, is you go back to making the components. It's like, oh, they didn't give me one. I want to go make my own.
Yeah. Some number of years ago, and I've posted this photo, and I will dig it out and attach it to this podcast episode. So people looking below the episode wondering what the hell is that picture? This is what, some friends of mine back when I lived in Columbus, a couple of the cabbies, the Panzer leader Panzer Blitz, Panzer Leader series of games are still fairly popular among a certain segment of the Grog audience out there. It's a 50-year-old design, and people are still playing it. I think that's pretty cool. And lots of variant counters had been released over the years in the general magazines, in some other magazines over the years. But a lot of people have put stuff online also of building their own variant counters, as well as people just simply making more of the existing counters. Some of my buddies from CABS put together this massive Panzer Leader battle, and it is essentially a divisional level engagement. Now, crank that over in your head for a second. Panzer Leader and Panzer Blitz is scaled at platoon level counters, and these guys had a divisional level battle on the table. So that tells you how many counters they had to print of their own to throw out there. They also had to print some additional map boards for the geomorphic maps. They ran this thing. It was 5 map boards deep by 3 map boards wide. And at 250 meter hexes, the math eludes me. I don't remember. I remember crunching the numbers at one point. But essentially, they had a divisional level engagement on the table of a lot of home printed counters because they had to. And a bunch of home printed maps because, again, they had to. It was an impressive sight. But I think it's the kind of thing you only get if you have people willing to engage in those kinds of modifications that we've been talking about. So, Ian, go ahead.
Yes. It brings you back to a game like Panzer Leader is truly a war engine. And I get that term actually out of the book Zones of Control, Perspectives of War Game, in one of their articles in there about war engines. It talks about how, you know, there's some war games out there that are monographs. They are a recreation of a battle, a single event, or a closely related series of events. Other games like Panzer Leader was really one of the first. Panzer Blitz was Panzer Blitz was Tactical Game 3 or something like that.
Yeah.
And the whole idea was that let's give war gamers a toolkit. Let's give them a basic set of rules. Let's give them some, you know, in many ways, some like simplified ways to depict the equipment, and let them go out and build more games. It was never really the intention of the publisher to be the end all for the source of everything. It was a toolkit delivered to the players. And I still think we have that nowadays. And nowadays, it's not just a toolkit just to build more scenarios, but nowadays, since we have access to what we were just talking about, greater ways to bling it out, our own version, our own experience of how to make it look and feel, we start playing with scenarios, which inevitably leads to playing with the components, which then inevitably leads to playing with the rules, because nobody likes the rules out of the box, apparently. everything is subject to change. And of course, the designer's wrong, and you're the customer is right.
Yeah, yeah. Tom Russell actually had a great thread on Twitter one day about, you know, it's one thing for someone to want to house rule something just simply because they enjoy playing it that way, and that's basically not a big deal. And I'm paraphrasing Tom's argument here, but I'm trying to do the best I can from memory. House ruling a game, okay, fine. We do some house ruling of things just because we want to enjoy them more. But to tell a designer that the game is broken is kind of insulting to the designer, because it may simply be that you just didn't understand what the designer was trying to do. And that, you know, that's happened plenty of times. It may be that the design is in fact broken. That does happen. There are also times where you just don't like what the designer did, and so you think it's broken when in fact it works fine. You just don't like it.
Yes.
You know, pineapple on pizza is not a broken pizza. It should be, but it's not. You just don't like pineapple on
then
pizza.
Then there's fighting words.
Because yeah, you're a human
I think
being.
I think that is a broken pizza.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I would say it's a broken pizza. My wife might dispute that. But Tom's woman. Twitter thread where this riff came from was Tom griping that someone had actually tried to argue that the game was broken based on something that had been read in the promotional material. I don't remember exactly what it was, but essentially someone was arguing that the game was broken when the game hadn't even been released yet, that this person could have even played it. And that seems a little nutty. But I think we're, you know, we've all house ruled something at some point in our lives, just either lack of clarity from the designer or the desire to try something different in the game, just wanting something else to play with, whatever it may have been, I think there's, we've all house ruled something at some point in our lives.
In the, again, showing my age, you know, in the old days, you had to house rule because, if you remember, you know, sending a question to like SPI and stuff, it was literally send them a self-addressed stamped envelope with your list of questions and make sure they're in a yes, no answer format. Cause that's all you're going to get. So you house ruled because you didn't have that communication with the designer. It was hard to have that back and forth and really get into their head and figure out what they were trying to say. That said, you know, in the old days, designer notes were pretty much a standard thing. These days, you don't get that as much because, you know, they got the internet. They can post their blog out there with their designer notes and you can go read it. But you're exactly right there, Brant, that sometimes you risk pissing off the designer because you don't understand their message. And so you try to change their message. Sometimes it's okay to change the message. And sometimes, you know, it's you've bought it. It's your game. You can do what you want with it. But to go and tell the designer that they're wrong and they need to change it to your way, well, maybe you need to understand what they were trying to do first before you go throwing those rocks around the glass house.
Yeah, yeah. Slow your roll there, Sparky.
And so, I mean, talking about house rules, it kind of brings up yet another form of game modification. And that would be, you know, have you ever taken rules from one game and poured them into another game? And maybe not even just rules, but have you maybe taken a game board from one game and played it with another? So kind of like mixing and matching, you know, game components and rules to kind of create your own game with
your own mashup,
your Frankenstein game.
So that is that you're sort of getting beyond sort of game to me. I mean, when I was younger, I did a heck of a lot of that because, I want to take my favorite of this game and put it in that game. I'll run it together. And sure. But at that point, you're becoming a game designer. Nowadays, I understand I'm becoming more of a game designer than just a game mod. Some games, you know, when you talk about some of the RPGs and some of the world building, you can maybe get away with that these days. Well, I mean, for other regular war games, I think now, as much as people maybe try to do it, the ones that are trying it maybe aren't so cognizant of the mechanics and the balance and what the designer was trying to say. And they're just trying to ignore all that and go off and create something that they think is cool and end up destroying what was actually a good piece of work. And then they go back and criticize the designer saying it's broken.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, Mike, I swear to the audience that Mike was not, you know, did not have that question planted ahead of time. But one of the last issues of Fire and Movement that I can remember reading, back when Fire and Movement still existed as a print issue. And if I recall, it was the last one where John Compton was the editor on Fire, but I wouldn't swear to that. There was, it was the culmination of a series of articles in that specific issue that had run for three or four issues before that. Someone had taken Flashpoint Golan rules and ported it to the Fifth Core series of games. And it had to obviously create new counters to be compatible with the Flashpoint Golan rules. And they had named this mashup the Flashpoint Central Front game. And I'm pretty sure it was the Fifth Core scenarios that they were doing. But essentially, they sort of slammed a different rule set onto an existing scenario and order of battle and all that. So they did have to figure out the numerical translation of stats from one to the other. But I believe the maps were scaled the same, whether it was, you know, 1 mile to hex or 5 miles per hex or whatever it was. Maybe it was 5 kilometers per hex, whatever the math worked out to. I think the two games were scaled the same. So they had to redo the counters because the combat factors were slightly different. Fifth Core obviously had the old friction point mechanic, which the Flashpoint Golan guys didn't. So this was truly that mashup that you're talking about, Mike. What these guys did is they were doing the AAR of the game. So they were describing the game as the turns progressed. So you got very little background as to here's how we actually created this mashup, but rather here's how the game unfolded as we played it with this Frankenstein set of rules and counters and maps and whatever. So it was exactly along the lines of what you were describing. That's just not how they wrote it.
That's probably a lot more detail, though, than I was even I was considering. I was just talking about taking things like maybe you have a game where you don't like the way that maybe logistics worked or something, or maybe command radius or maybe spotting, and you just take this other game where you like the way spotting rules work and you bring it into the game where you don't, and just, you know, maybe just change one or two things. But yeah, what you're talking about, you know, that's a huge that'd be a huge modification to the game.
Yeah. I mean,
then I think you're getting into designing. Exactly. I think that's what Ian was getting at. You're kind of becoming a game designer at that point.
Yeah. I wouldn't argue with that characterization at all. I think that's absolutely accurate. I was fascinated by the concept, and, you know, sort of a little dumbstruck that somebody had that much free time on their hands. But it was a really neat way to approach that game combo and see what came out the other side. You know, it was kind of cool to see and read about what these guys had done and how they had done it. It was kind of fascinating. I will say, in terms of sort of, I have done a little bit of that mashup work myself. A bit when I was a kid, my dad had the Modern Battles quads from SPI, both 1 and 2. And like all of those other quads out there, the West Wall quad, the East Front quad, you know, the Bulge quad, the Blue and Gray quad 1 and 2, there was a Pacific War quad. What's great about those things is that you had your basic set of rules, you had a couple of game-specific ones, but they all worked off of the same basic set of, you know, move, shoot, communicate kind of rules.
Yeah.
And I was taking the stuff from Mod Quad 2, and I was swapping pieces out between the games. And yeah. So in the Jerusalem game, which was an Arab-Israeli scenario, I went ahead and threw the Americans in there just because. Like, geopolitically, that's just not ever going to happen, you know, but when you're 13, you don't care. You just want to push some cool counters around, and here's some different ones. I have them on the shelf. I know what's in there. The four games in Mod Quad 2, there was DMZ. So that was the U.S. and South Koreans against the Norks. There was the Yugoslavia game, which was the U.S. and Italians and the Soviets meeting around Zagreb, and the Yugoslavians, depending on the scenario, flipped between the sides. In some cases, they were pro-NATO. In some cases, they were pro-Soviet. In at least one scenario, there was a Yugoslavian civil war, which I thought was pretty prescient of those guys, you know, designing a game in 1977 or whatever it was. One of the games was Würzburg, so it's the U.S. meets the Soviets out there in the middle of Bavaria. And one game was Bundeswehr. This was before the Assault Series game of the same name. The Bundeswehr game was the Germans and Brits against the Russians up in the North German plain. So it was a very rare, you know, NATO versus the Russians game that didn't have Americans in it until I got a hold of it. Suddenly there's Americans showing up in Bundeswehr. Suddenly there's Brits showing up in Yugoslavia. You know, I got all of the American forces together across both the Yugoslavia and DMZ game and put them up against the Russians from both the Yugoslavia and Bundeswehr game because I could.
And it was fun, right? I mean, that's all we do these things.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, one of the other things that you get to do as a part of this is you get to put together some mass battles that never have happened otherwise, simply because counter mixes and the rules didn't support it. But it was fun to play around with. You know, it was fun to poke at that and start doing your own scenarios. So, Ian, going back to your toolkit idea, I took something that was decidedly not intended as a toolkit and turned it into exactly that because I was a bored teenager.
What you're talking about there is actually what a lot of the good games that are those toolkits support. I mean, I would imagine that something like for Multiman Publishing with their standard combat series. If you look at what those games are, it's a standard combat series, standard set of rules. But every one of the games sort of has like a little gimmick. Panzer Battles uses the chip pool mechanic. So somebody went out there and said, hey, you know, standard combat series, this is great, but instead of I go, you go, what happens if we put chip pool in here? Somebody else goes, hey, you know what? I don't like this standard 3-to-1 CRT. So I'm going to throw in a different combat results table, and you end up with Iron Curtain. Just go look at whatever SCS game is out there to look at it as a little gimmick, and it probably came from someplace else and somebody said, I really like this. I want to put it together and you end up with a good game. I just remember what I think it was Dunnigan wrote in his book, you know, about war game design is plagiarize, plagiarize, plagiarize. If something works out there, you know, go ahead and, you know, keep it going and keep it working in your game.
Yeah. To steal from one is plagiarizing, to steal from many is research. That's how that works. I definitely agree in terms of let's go find a toolkit and put something together. I'm not as familiar with the SCS series game, so I'll take your word for it, but it sounds, you know, eminently reasonable from what I know of how those rules work and are put together. I think if you're just able to find some, you know, the magic combination of the same rules, not the same rules, the same scale is really the key thing in terms of the counter sizes, the hex, you know, the map sizes. Because if you're taking Lock and Load Tactical and you're putting it on an ASL map, the hexes are scaled the same, so you don't have to do any math to convert ranges at all. You know, you can quibble about the combat power as however you want to, if you think certain units are overrated or underrated. But the basic physics pieces of it, a squad of guys can run this far in this amount of time. And so the hex, the movement scale doesn't really have to change. The range scale doesn't have to change. I think if you start mashing things up at that point, that's a good place to start. That was one of the things that made the mod quad so easy to mash up, is that everything scaled the same across the whole series of games. So
yep. They gave you a warning.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things you'd been talking about some on your personal blog was kind of playing around with the Striker rule set, playing around with some of the sci-fi ground combat rules and minis and counters and bits and pieces. So tell us a little bit about your explorations there and what you've come up with, and how would you characterize that, if at all, as some sort of game mod?
So the Striker is part of the larger Traveler universe, Traveler RPG universe. And Traveler really is a RPG that can be different things to different people. For some people who just want to play a social game, you certainly can do that. Although your character may die in character generation if you play by older classic rules. Some people say it's too many subsystems, but actually if you just go down to the core mechanic, it's pretty simple. But that said, the other extreme is the Traveler universe can be what designer Mark Miller himself called a very system design game. You have One beautiful thing about the Traveler universe to me, one of the things that I really love about it, is that all those different subsystems, be it ship design, vehicle design, weapon design, thing design, it all hangs together, and it all, you can make something in one and you can figure out how it works and it relates to the other. Striker was a little bit of an interesting piece. That's a Frank Chadwick design. It's many times, in many ways, a predecessor to his Command Decision series and First Battle series, Assault series. There's a lot of lineage in those rules and such. But that said, it's also very flexible. And I think that's where the game mod comes. I mean, he was trying to design a game that, he gives a famous, not famous. I once heard him talk at, I think it was a mid-2010s conference. He was talking about the 30th anniversary of Traveler, so that was what, you know, 2011 or something like that. And he said one of the greatest compliments he had is that Striker is the best set of rules for ancients, because he captured not the technology, he captured some of the essence of warfare, leadership, you know, communications on the battlefield and that sort of stuff, which brings me back to my toolkit sort of things. He gave us a toolkit, and you can play around and, you know, put whatever equipment you want in there, put whatever unit organization you want in there. But the basic rules and the basic what he's trying to deliver still stands, and you can play around with it all day, and it'll still work. That's what I've been exploring in some of those games. There is a lot of those were. A lot of the Traveler universe had Frank Chadwick on the war game side of it, helping out. So be it the man-to-man combat systems all the way up to, you know, small unit tactics. It's a toolkit. And in the RPG world, that toolkit really does fit together because as a GM, you want to be the world builder. You want to build that setting or modify that setting for your players. And it actually works quite well. So Frank Chadwick, thank you, gave us some good war games that you can play in RPGs that are very extensible and you can play around with and do a lot of things with.
Mike, your reactions.
I've heard of Stryker, but I've never used it with Traveler or anything else. So I was just as Ian was speaking, I was looking it up on the internet here. I was reading about Stryker.
1981, and miniatures rules for 15mm. Which
apparently there was a Stryker rulebook 2. So was there a second edition of this?
So Stryker 2 was part of the Traveler New Era piece. Again, it's Frank. Frank Chadwick. A lot of the, by the time Stryker 2 came out, I think was like the mid 90s, like 1993. So by that point, you could see a very clear lineage from Stryker to his like command decision series of miniature rules. Stryker 2, to me, Stryker 2 is the sci-fi version or sci-fi edition of his command decision rules, because you had command decision over the top. I forget what the modern version was called. And then Stryker 2 was like the sci-fi version, but all the same basic rule set that if you look at that, it actually looks a lot like Assault in some ways, which looks a lot like Frank Chadwick's, and as you can see, traces it to his first battle series of games. He hit upon a good formula for bringing those battles together, using a sort of a single core rule set, but throwing it into different periods of time, adding extra rules, you know, some of your variant rules or, you know, the chrome to give it that period feel. But the core mechanics were essentially the same across the entire series.
Yeah. The first battles and assault are very closely linked, in terms of their mechanics. The assault rules, I think, intentionally grafted on some particular stuff to try and account for that Soviet doctrine of mass uber alles. But for the most part, the first battle versus assault, piece, that's almost going back to your SCS discussion of there's a lot,
yes,
in those series of games that is pretty interchangeable.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I don't know that was intentionally by design. It just sort of worked out that way, but it's still true. There's a lot between
them. I think Frank hit upon a formula, and it worked. It was a good the minis world liked it, and he could translate that into a hex and counter world. So what was Stryker and command decision ended up into assault and first battle. And some of those, even it goes backwards. Some of those games could even go backwards. I know people that did back in the day did assault and put it into minis again. So, I mean, it all went full circle. But the point is, I mean, he gave us games that we could mod, games that he was modding into different time periods, eras, you know, take a core mechanic, throw in some period chrome, and voila, you have a new game.
Yeah.
So one thing you're talking about Traveler, and this is Brant's fault, but so one thing I do remember from Traveler, it's all coming back now, was something called Snapshot, and it was like a combat on starships type thing, kind of a miniatures, yes, thing like you're talking about. Is Stryker related to that in any way? Is it something totally different? Is it?
So no. Traveler started off with its Traveler, what they called themselves, the Traveler combat system in the class of Traveler, which used ranged bands. And if you remember, there was a sort of a table that was sort of a lookup table. You'd have like a pistol versus different armor. That grew into Snapshot, which then became a set of rules for Azanti High Lightning, which were all close combat rules. Along the way, it became progressively more war game, where the original classic Traveler rules were, hey, you have an action, you have a major action and a minor action. When you got into Snapshot, you started saying, hey, you have action points. And by the way, Snapshot has my favorite rule ever. One of the action points, for one action point, you could expend for an expletive. because sometimes you're like waiting for that door to open, So you had to, you know, wait two action points or three action points. So what do you do? Well, you sit there and go, I'm going to drop three expletives. and I'm fine. Okay. The door's open. I can keep going now, because it was an action point system. Every individual had a certain number of action points that they could execute. Azani Highlighting took it up a different, you know, did the same thing, the action point step. So Striker. So there's the schism. And I did an article on my own blog a while back, not too long ago, talking about this sort of this, hey, there's all these different systems out there. And there's some of them have a heritage, the Frank Chadwick Striker lineage. But then there's this other Traveler combat system that then broke into this Snapshot Azanti High Lightning. But nowadays you got the game coming back around to just the very classic RPG mechanics of, hey, you know, you, it's combat round. Who's got the initiative? And you have, you know, one minor action or two minor actions and one major action. You can trade, you know, your major action for two minors, things like that. But Snapshot was fun because you put it on the little chart there. You have the deck plans. So that fed into that whole deck plans piece.
I'm looking at the design credits now, and I see Frank Chadwick's name is mentioned there.
Chadwick was right there. He was part of the GDW crew.
Yeah. Copyright 1979.
Yeah. I still have my original edition.
The little black books.
Yeah.
And I don't have the first edition. I think I have the second edition of the little black books, the 1980, I think it's the 1980 or 81 version. There wasn't a heck of a lot of difference between the first and the second, but I think somebody said there was what was the difference? It was something I thought was minor.
The bigger difference came when it got to High Guard.
Yeah.
First edition High Guard and the second edition High Guard had some pretty good changes in it. But that was 1980.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, with this crew on the line, the primary focus we were looking at for mods, we were going to be primarily talking tabletop gaming, because that was the part that Mike, that you had brought up in the original discussion of, hey, what kind of topics should we have with the podcast of this season? And knowing that Ian had poked around a little with some of the sci-fi stuff and that was your shtick, I figured we'd throw y'all on here together and see what we get. I know that I had house ruled any number of things over the years. We did a lot of different house ruling to some Battletech stuff that we had done over the years, especially once MechWarrior came out and you had the RPG component to sort of change up the stats of the guys actually driving the mechs. We definitely house ruled a bunch of things to allow those MechWarriors to be more accurately reflected, or we felt more accurately reflected in the way the mechs themselves fought. Going back to the Mod Quad series, and this is true of a couple of other series of similar, of contemporary games from SPI at the time, one of the things I hated with the way the artillery was put together is that the artillery had this final protective fire that was essentially lock the guns on a target and unload all your ammo. And probably because I grew up the son of a red leg, you know, that's not really what we do with these things. That was sort of a Vietnam era tactic that was no longer in vogue, but was the last time the U.S. Army had shot live rounds at anybody. So that's what the designers kind of ran with. And so we had house ruled the FPF stuff kind of away, but sort of reimagined that a little bit for the games that had that mechanic in them. I want to say there were a couple of the Arab-Israeli conflicts that were presented from SPI at the time that had the similar artillery rules to the Mod Quad series. So that was another something that we did differently, where we sort of tweaked what was in the original rules. I remember those specifically. Around the table, Ian, what do you got? What are some of the things that you specifically remember making some changes?
I remember taking SPI's Commando and trying to make it work in my Traveler games. That was the early days. The SPI Commando is almost its own role playing game, but I had to change it to fit my role playing game. I went back and I found some of my old counter sheets and I looked at my hand drawn counters and I'm like, oh, how hideous. Nowadays with the ability to publish much more, drawing up a nice map, getting a good file to do that, making modifications, changing colors. I think we've all done it, some more than others. I don't have a 3D printer, so I haven't gone that route yet. My boys are trying to push me that way, so we'll see what happens.
The 3D printing craze is starting to get a little on the ridiculous side. I actually noted it in today's Tuesday Newsday that the 3D printing craze has completely overwhelmed any search that you might do for the term war game in Kickstarter. What you get is an endless litany of 3D printer files for all sorts of different things with the air quotes around war game, like stuff that is not a combat setting that most of us would consider war games, but are in fact combat games in any number of sci-fi or fantasy universes that barely resemble anything that we would think of as Grog style reality. Whether we want to consider those war games or not, generally when we're looking for a war game to see what's on Kickstarter, if we're looking for something like Shores of Tripoli, if we're looking for something like Rommel in the Desert that Columbia just put up there in the past week, you're not finding those if you search Kickstarter for war game these days. What you find is an endless scroll of STL files. It's just the reality of what's out there right now. It's a little disheartening because it makes it that much harder to find, you know, those tabletop hex encounter kind of grog fests that we would be looking for as war gamers. Not that I don't enjoy some of the other stuff. Lord knows I've got a mountain of fantasy and sci-fi role playing material here in the office with me, but that's not what I'm looking for when I'm on Kickstarter looking for war games. So,
but it's going to be, that is the future. I mean, look at Academy Games. They're 1775 little tiny cubes. But by the time they get to 878 Vikings, they got the little plastic warriors.
Yep.
I've seen them showing mock-ups for replacing the cubes in 1775 with the actual little soldiers, redcoats and continentals. It's going to be interesting to see how the hobby evolves as the cost of those pieces keep coming down, and you can, hey, I don't need a flat little piece of a cardboard with a NATO symbol on it. I can actually, you know, have this little tiny, I mean, even if you go like Pico armor with their 2mm minis tank, you can do a lot with that in some of your older games.
I know a lot of folks have, and we actually mentioned this on one of the talk shows during the ACDC. I've seen other people take Lock and Loads tank on tank and swap out the counters for tank and infantry minis. The scaling actually works pretty well to use the Wizards Axis and Allies collectible minis game to swap out the figures, the infantry figures, the anti-tank guns, the tanks, the different vehicles, and use the Axis and Allies minis maps and just use the tank on tank rules. It's actually a better game. it's a lot of fun. And so that's right up the alley of what you're talking about there. One thing that is kind of interesting for those that don't know. So John Compton, longtime wargamer, mentioned him earlier as a previous editor of Fire Movement magazine. John's a professional wargamer, works for the Office of Secretary of Defense doing professional wargaming stuff. John also runs Canvas Temple Publishing, which is a wargame print house that he opened up just for him and some friends to, quite frankly, it's vanity projects, right? It's things they're doing, the things they want to do because they want to do them. So they've got an Atlantic Wall game. They got an Admiral's War. They're redoing an older Solitaire Stalingrad game that's coming out soon. Mike, stop salivating. but one of the other things that John sells in the Canvas Temple store is they've got a whole bunch of 3D printed terrain and minis and other 3D printed stuff that it's John's kids. John's kids got really interested in this and started putting together their own sculpts and printing some things out, and were selling some to, I don't know if it was smaller local cons or local hobby shops or whatever. And so John sat down with him and had a conversation and said, hey, look, want to be a part of this business? Is this something we want to do? And so as a way of encouraging them to kind of take ownership of doing some stuff on their own, he's incorporated them into the Canvas Temple business, which is kind of cool.
You forgot to mention the other side of the Canvas Temple business, is that he does support the old Grognards. I mean, his whole World War II deluxe game was purposely done with an extra large map and extra large hexes and extra large counters. So that
I didn't want to get too far ahead of the article you were writing for us, so I was trying not to.
Spoiler alert.
So I don't need my magnifying glass to look at the half-inch counters to read the name of that warship. Is that what you're saying?
No, because they're one-inch counters.
Nice.
Well, and again, this goes back to, you know, these guys designing the games they want to design because they want to design them. And so they're making the things they want to play because they're fun for them.
Yep.
That's the core shtick behind what the Canvas Temple, that's just kind of who they wanted to be, which is cool. Like, you know, we should all be so lucky as to be able to follow our muse like that. But when you mention the 3D printed stuff, that's definitely a place for that. So, Mike, last thoughts on game mod stuff that you may have fiddled with throughout your life there.
Well, first off, before I get onto that, I will say that I think a 3D printer is in my future somewhere. Just, the prices have just, they've really dropped, and it's almost too hard to pass up. But no, as far as things, the first game that I modded, that I actually did, that I house ruled, I guess we're talking about house rules, was Starfleet Battles. And what happened, and this is when I was in high school, this is how long ago this was. Starfleet Battles has this thing called energy allocation, which is fine if you're playing a game where you have, you know, three or four starships going at each other. Not bad. But my friend and I, we love to play fleet battles. And so if you're going to try to run energy allocation on fleets of ships fighting, it's, you know, you're going to spend more time doing spreadsheet work than playing the game. So one of the things we did was we just kind of tossed out energy allocation entirely and came up with a system where you just looked at the number of warp blocks a ship had, kind of come up with a percentage and guesstimate, you know, can this ship fire a phaser? Can this ship do warp 3? Well, he had 30 warp engine blocks. He's down to 15. He could probably hit warp 3 if he wanted to. So it sped the game up tremendously, and it was fun, and we had a great time. So that was probably the first modification that I did.
Somewhere.
Yeah. And so, and lately it's been more graphical modification. Like I said, I've created my own custom map boards. Cataclysm, I didn't like the fact that Germany had gray cubes. I bought black ones, so I changed those out. I'm working on a neoprene map right now for Command and Colors and Horse and Musket. I'm going to have a neoprene hex map for that because I'm not a big fan of the boards that came with those. Warfighter War II, I bought a bucket of army men from Amazon so I can have U.S. troops and Japanese troops, and maybe I'll paint them, maybe I won't, but I've got them. So, there's no end in sight. I'm going to be modding games from now on. It's just it's an immersion thing to me, you know, and I'm more connected with a game, I guess, when I do it.
Yeah, I don't know that it's outside the scope of what we were intending to talk tonight, but I do think that there for gamers of a certain age, which we all are of those certain ages at this point, I think for a lot of us, one of the first places where we started modding games, quite frankly, was in the role-playing world, because how many of us didn't invent, you know, we all went off and invented our own classes thinking that one of these days we were going to submit them to Dragon Magazine. Hey, I've got a great idea for a new class, right? It's the assassin acrobat, not the thief acrobat. He's totally different. He's an assassin acrobat. And we came up with all sorts of foolishness like that. You know, we did these things and foisted them upon the world when we came up with these ideas for whatever different rules mods we were playing around with over the years. So I think we're all guilty of it at some point. I will say, so audience, we've talked a lot about our mods out there. Please chime into the comments below this podcast episode or hop in our forums where we've got the feedback on the podcast. We're kind of curious, what kinds of mods have you tried over the years? What are some of the things you've done? What are some of the small tweaks that you put into place to a specific game, whether it was a house rule that you put in or something you thought was broken that you needed to fix, or you just wanted to speed stuff up like Mike with Starfleet Battles there. Or have you actually gone further than just designing your own scenarios for an existing game? Did you actually mash up multiple games? Did you take the Flashpoint Golan rules and use them in the Central Front? Did you, you know, completely swap out one set of naval combat for another in a big grand game? What are some of the things you've done?
Yeah, and I would say I would say that's exactly the intent of this podcast idea. I really, more than any other, you know, time, please, this is, I really want to hear the feedback on this one. It's like I said, I don't see a lot of it out there. And so to hear what people are doing, I think that would be really, really neat.
Yeah. I'm definitely interested in kind of finding out what some of the other things people have done, you know, turned out to, you know, and again, we've spent this podcast primarily talking war game stuff. 'Cause even the Striker rules for the Traveler universe were war game stuff. We hadn't even crossed the boundary into the kinds of mods that you can do to role playing games. We've intentionally avoided Mike dominating an hour telling us how every game can be a solo game by modding it appropriately.
That's true. And I did have a note to talk about RPGs, and like you said, we didn't really go down that road, but that's maybe a different podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we're over an hour as it is, so you know, it's going to have to be a different podcast, but we'll definitely come back around to it at some point. And so, Ian, I'm sure you'll continue to talk about some of your explorations in modding games there on your blog. Yes. But yeah, audience, definitely chime in. We're very interested in sort of hearing what you have to say about some of these things. I did say that, you know, when we got back around to the end of the show, we're making it a point. So for our Patreon, the way we've got it set up for the Armchair Dragoons, again, patreon.com/armchairdragoons, there are three levels of support that we've got pre-configured on there. And the first level is just, hey, you're a supporter. We really appreciate your help. You've got our undying gratitude. That one, the minimum charge on Patreon is $1 a month. But we have two levels above that, both a $5 and a $10 level. For folks that join at the $5 level and above, we are going to hold a live streaming event each month. We're going to have one get together with all of our Patreon supporters at the $5 level and above. So we'll probably use Zoom or Discord, one or the other, and we'll all hop on and turn on the cameras and have a conversation together and just sort of a happy hour for the Patreon folks. If you join us at the $10 level, not only do you get access to those live events, you also get early bird registration to any of our events like the ACDC or any other convention or special event kinds of things and since we have another one of those conventions coming up this summer, you're going to get a chance to use it here, you know, within a couple of months. But also at the $10 level, we said that if you join us at the $10 level, we're going to give you a by name shout out on the podcast. And so we already have two folks supporting us at the $10 level.
Nice.
And so, yeah. So special thanks to Kevin Bertram. Kevin's the guy that runs Fort Circle Games. He was the designer of Shores of Tripoli and the forthcoming Halls of Montezuma. You can tell where Kevin's military service loyalties lie. A little obvious there. Kevin, we love you anyway.
Thank you very much for
being a Patreon supporter for us. And then Patrick Garrity is also a longtime friend of the Dragoons and has joined us at the $10 level. I feel like I sound like a televangelist here, but I did promise I was going to give these guys a by name shout out here. I feel like the Wayne Newton character from License to Kill from the Bond flick, you know, standing up there doing the televangelism thing. But I did want to make a point, you know, thank you very much to like all of our supporters because we're already in double digits supporters for this Patreon and we haven't even been live a week at this point. So that's really kind of, I mean, it'll be, you know, 2 weeks and change by the time people are hearing this podcast. But as we're recording, we haven't been live a week and we've hit double digit supporters on the Patreon. And that's just awesome because it's going to allow us to have some technology upgrades as well as, you know, making sure that the hosting stays live for us and everything. And so that's great.
It keeps the lights on, right? I mean,
exactly. Exactly. Look, nobody's going out to dinner on this, right? This is not, nobody's buying steak dinners. Ian's like, well, damn it. What am I doing here? But you know, nobody's buying steak dinners on this. This is simply to try and, you know, help, you know, support and keep the website live and running and everything. One of the other things just to mention quickly is that at both the $5 and $10 levels, we've capped those at a certain number of supporters. And I want to say it's 25 and 10. I know we've capped it at 10 total supporters at the $10 level. I know we've capped it at the $5 level, but I don't want it. I probably should have been better prepared for all of this part of the spiel, but Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's kind of our shtick. Thank you to those folks. Thank you to Kevin and Patrick, especially, like I said, call them out by name on the podcast. And so we've done that. And so thank you guys and appreciate it. So Ian, Mike, thank you guys very much for helping launch season 6. Ian, I think this is 2 seasons in a row that you've been on the first episode, hasn't it?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe we don't do a steak dinner, but maybe a pineapple pizza.
I'm gonna house rule that one.
Yeah, and I'm gonna mod it out, right?
Exactly.
So all right, so thank you, Ian, thank you, Mike, for joining us for the for the launch of season 6 of Mentioned in Dispatches. This is great. We love that our fans have helped keep us around for this long. We hope you enjoy some of the other fun stuff we've got coming up during season 6, and we hope you'll look forward to hearing us again next week. So thanks, everybody, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Good night.
Good night.